You know that deeply frustrating feeling when you decide, as an adult, that you're finally going to learn a new
Oh,
language.
I know it well. It's a total grind.
Right. I mean, you download the apps, you
Yeah.
study the flashcards, you repeat these phrases until your throat literally hurts, but the vocabulary just bounces right off your brain.
Yeah, it feels like nothing sticks.
Exactly. But then you look at a toddler, and they just exist in a room where a language is being spoken, and somehow they just soak it up like a sponge.
It's completely effortless for them.
It really is. And it's not just language, you know?
Yeah.
It's the exact same feeling when you try to fundamentally change an ingrained habit or unlearn a fear or even rebuild trust after you've been hurt.
Right, because the adult brain feels like it is locked down tight.
Yeah, lockdown, whereas the childhood brain is just wide open.
Yeah.
And for anyone who loves learning, or honestly, anyone trying to heal, that biological reality feels like a terrible cosmic joke.
It really does. I mean, it feels like we're constantly punishing ourselves for a lack of willpower, you know? We blame ourselves when we can't just snap out of a trauma response or pick up a new skill on a weekend.
Like it's a personal failing.
Exactly. But in reality, we are fighting against the fundamental physical architecture of our own nervous system.
But what if, and this is the huge question for today, what if that architecture isn't as permanent as we always thought?
Right. What if we could change it?
Yeah, what if there's actually a biochemical way to temporarily unlock the adult brain and, return it to that effortless, sponge-like state of childhood?
It's a massive concept.
It is. So welcome to today's deep dive. We're jumping into a truly fascinating article from the August 17, 2026 edition of the OTW Journal.
It's a great piece.
It really is. And our mission today is to explore some groundbreaking neuroscience that suggests psychedelics might act as this master key to reopen the adult brain's childhood learning windows.
Which is just, we are witnessing a profound shift right now in how the scientific community understands these substances.
A total shift.
Yeah, we're moving entirely away from looking at psychedelics merely as tools for generating mystical experiences or altered states of consciousness. Instead, the research is framing them as molecular mechanisms that can fundamentally rewire our understanding of human biology and therapy, too.
It's mind-blowing. And before we get into the weeds here, I want to formally welcome you, the listener, to this deep dive. We are going to be unpacking some heavy biology today, but we promise to keep it grounded.
We'll try our best.
Right. So to understand this whole concept of a master key, we first have to understand the lock itself. Like, what exactly is keeping our adult brains so incredibly rigid? And the article talks about these developmental windows called critical periods.
Yeah, so to really grasp critical periods, we have to go back to a Nobel-winning experiment by two neuroscientists named Hubel and Wiesel. They were studying the visual system back in the 1960s, basically trying to understand how the brain learns to see.
Right, the kitten experiment.
Exactly. They did this really famous experiment where they temporarily covered one eye of a kitten during a specific, very early window of its life.
And I should clarify for everyone, we were just talking about a temporary patch over the eye, right?
Yeah.
Not causing any actual physical damage to the eye itself.
That is the vital detail. Yes. The eye was perfectly healthy.
Okay, good.
But because it was covered during this specific developmental window, the brain permanently rewired itself away from the deprived eye.
Wow.
It dedicated all its processing power to the open eye. And here's the crazy part. Even after the patch was removed weeks later, the kitten never developed proper binocular vision.
So it was just permanent.
Yes, the brain had physically pruned those unused connections. That specific window of time in the kitten's infancy was the absolute only chance the brain had to wire that visual circuit correctly.
But the kicker, and the thing that basically established a dogma in neuroscience for decades, is what happened when they tried the exact same experiment on a fully grown adult cat.
Right. When they covered the eye of an adult cat for the exact same amount of time, absolutely nothing happened to its visual wiring.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. The brain didn't rewire itself at all, the window had closed, and the flexibility was just gone.
And since then, neuroscientists have mapped out these critical periods for all sorts of developmental milestones,
Oh,
right?
absolutely.
Like we have critical periods for the sounds we use in our native language, which is why, learning Japanese is super easy at age two, but incredibly hard at age 40.
Right, the phonetic windows close.
Yeah. There are critical periods for how birds learn their specific mating songs, and most importantly for our discussion today, critical periods for the formation of secure social attachments.
Yes, and they all operate on their own strict developmental clocks.
So it's not just one big window for the whole brain.
Exactly. And for almost a century, the assumption in neuroscience was that once these critical period windows closed, they were locked shut for good.
Just a hard deadline.
Yeah, it was considered one of biology's non-negotiable deadlines.
But why did they close? I mean, if being a sponge is so amazing for learning, why does the brain actively stop being a sponge?
It actually comes down to physical structures forming inside the brain.
Okay.
As a neural circuit matures during childhood and finishes its learning phase, it literally gets wrapped up in these dense lattices made of protein and sugar.
Like a physical wrapping?
Yes. They're called paraneuronal nets. You can picture them as a kind of molecular cast that grows entirely around the neurons.
Wow.
And it stabilizes the wiring and physically locks the connections into place so they cannot easily be altered.
That makes a lot of sense. So think of the childhood brain, like freshly poured wet cement, right?
That's it.
You can draw lines in it, press your hand into it, you know, shape it however you need to based on your environment. But as you get older, those paraneuronal nets form, which is basically the cement drying.
Exactly.
Locks everything into place. The lines you drew are now permanent.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it drastically changes how we view adult learning. Your adult brain isn't somehow less capable or broken compared to a child's brain.
Right.
It is simply more fixed by this extracellular scaffolding. And, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, that fixity is a brilliant necessary feature.
Because it keeps us functioning.
Right. You do not want your visual system renegotiating how to process depth perception every single week. You want it to be stable so you can survive.
I certainly don't want to wake up and have to relearn how to walk or how to recognize my family's faces every morning.
Exactly. It would be chaos.
But the downside to that evolutionary stability is that relearning things later in life becomes a monumental task.
It really does.
Trying to recover motor function after a stroke, or trying to unlearn a deeply ingrained trauma response, or attempting to rebuild trust after a betrayal. All of these things are incredibly difficult because you were trying to draw new lines in dry cement.
Yes. The physical scaffolding is actively fighting your efforts to change.
So if these paraneuronal nets are the dry cement locking us in, researchers naturally started looking for a chemical solvent, right? Like, could a drug dissolve the net?
That was the big question.
And that question led a team at Johns Hopkins University, specifically neuroscientists Gold Dolan and Romain Nardou, to conduct a landmark study in 2019.
This 2019 study is where the paradigm completely shifts.
Yeah, it's wild.
They were looking at mice, specifically focusing on a critical period that governs social reward learning.
Okay, let's define that because it sounds a bit clinical.
Sure.
Social reward learning is basically the developmental phase when a young animal learns to find the company of its peers rewarding. It's the biological foundation of how they learn to bond and trust, right?
That's spot on.
And in mice, this window of social reward learning is wide open during adolescence, but it firmly shuts by the time they reach adulthood.
Right. The adult mice are generally much less interested in forming new rewarding social bonds than the adolescent mice. Their social habits are just locked in.
Dry cement.
Exactly. But Dolan and Nardou did something unprecedented. They gave these adult mice a single dose of MDMA.
And the critical period actually reopened.
It did.
Long after it was supposed to be permanently shut, the adult mice who received the MDMA were suddenly able to form those youthful, rewarding associations with their peers all over again.
Which was huge. It was the first time anyone had ever demonstrated that a drug could pry open a specific closed behavioral window.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second because I know what you might be thinking listening to this. MDMA is famously a party drug, right?
Yes.
It makes people feel euphoric and intensely connected to everyone around them. So couldn't the mice just be acting friendlier because MDMA simply makes you high and happy?
That's a very fair question.
Like, maybe it's not some deep biological rewriting. Maybe they're just temporarily rolling.
That is the exact skepticism the scientific community had, and it is what the researchers painstakingly controlled for.
Okay.
They proved that this was not just a general temporary mood boost. The reopening of the critical period depended specifically on oxytocin signaling in a very specific part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens.
And the nucleus accumbens is basically the brain's reward hub, right?
Well,
it's the score for what feels good.
Yes. So the drug was not just making them happy. It was literally switching the plasticity machinery back on.
Wow.
When oxytocin hits the nucleus accumbens during this highly plastic state, the brain physically rewires itself to associate social connection with reward all over again.
That's incredible.
And if you think about the implications for humans, it is staggering. Think about MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD.
Right.
What is that therapy actually asking a patient to do? It is asking them to fundamentally relearn safety and to relearn trust in human relationships after a severe trauma.
Which is exactly the kind of social relearning that this specific critical period governs. So the patient isn't just having a pleasant afternoon on a therapist's couch. Their brain is chemically reverting to a state where it is physically capable of absorbing new truths about safety and connection.
Yes.
It's overriding the fear that had been locked into the dry cement.
The drug creates the biological conditions necessary for the therapy to actually take root at a structural level.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
But it immediately begs another massive question. If MDMA works by flooding the brain with oxytocin and serotonin, is this just a weird quirk of MDMA?
Right. Is it unique?
Yeah. Or is there a universal rule hiding here? Mm-hmm. Does this apply to other altered states? And that question drives us straight into the 2023 follow-up study from the exact same lab.
This 2023 paper became one of the most talked about pieces of research in modern neuroscience.
I can see why.
The team at Johns Hopkins wanted to know if other psychedelic compounds could do the exact same thing.
And the results are fascinating because it wasn't just one type of drug. They tested a whole panel.
A very diverse panel.
They tested classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin. They tested ketamine. They tested ibogaine. And every single one of those classic psychedelics successfully reopened the critical period in the mice.
Every single one.
But here is the crucial control. They also tested cocaine, which is obviously a very powerful reinforcer that alters brain chemistry significantly, and they tested saline.
Right.
Cocaine and saline did absolutely nothing.
It was a wildly consistent result across a diverse group of psychedelic compounds.
Wait, I need to pause here. This is the paradox that really broke my brain when I was reading the source material.
Okay, let's hear it.
You are telling me that a drug like ketamine, which blocks the NMDA receptor, which usually transmits excitatory signals, and LSD, which binds to the serotonin 2A receptor to change how neurons communicate, both result in the exact same nets dissolving.
Yes.
How does the brain even know to do that?
Yeah.
That feels like pushing a print button on a keyboard and a volume up button on a television remote, but they both somehow magically open your garage door?
That's a funny way to put it.
It doesn't make any sense.
What's fascinating here is that the researchers were just as puzzled initially. You have serotonergic drugs and non-serotonergic drugs taking completely different pharmacological pathways.
Right.
But the researchers discovered that they all converge downstream.
Downstream?
Yes.
Yeah.
No matter which receptor they hit initially, whether it is serotonin or NMDA or a dozen different targets in the case of ibogaine, the ultimate downstream event inside the cell is exactly the same.
Wow.
They all trigger a remodeling of the paraneuronal nets and a reactivation of the plasticity machinery.
So it's like having different physical keys, the different drugs that are cut for entirely different locks, the different brain receptors.
Uh-huh.
But somehow, no matter which lock you turn, they all open the exact same door, the paraneuronal nets dissolve, and the cement gets wet again.
That is why Gold Dolan refers to psychedelics as a potential master key.
Master key. It makes perfect sense now.
This finding suggests that reopening critical periods isn't just a quirk of the serotonin system. It is a shared fundamental property of these compounds. They possess a shared mechanism to unlock the extracellular scaffolding.
And the article points out that if this master key dissolves the nets globally, it might not just be for social reward learning.
Oh, definitely not.
It could potentially reopen the critical periods for motor recovery after a stroke, or for visual processing, or for all kinds of foundational learning that we thought was permanently locked away.
The therapeutic potential is boundless if that holds true across different neural circuits.
So exciting.
But as we move forward in the study, the research revealed another detail that completely shifts how we need to think about these experiences in a clinical setting, and it has to do with the biological clock.
Right, because if we've established that all these different drugs open the door, the most urgent practical question becomes, how long does the door actually stay open?
Exactly.
Like, does the cement dry the minute the drug wears off and the hallucinations stop?
This is perhaps the single most arresting detail in the entire 2023 study. The reopened window did not stay open for a fixed universal amount of time for every drug.
Okay.
Instead, the time the window stayed open was directly proportional to the duration of the drug's acute effects.
meaning how long the actual trip lasts, dictates how long the brain stays plastic afterward.
Let's look at the data. Ketamine creates a very short acute experience, usually an hour or two.
Right.
In the mice, ketamine kept the critical period open for roughly 48 hours.
Okay, 2 days.
Yes. Psilocybin and LSD, which have much longer acute effects lasting anywhere from 6 to 12 hours, kept the window open significantly longer.
And what about ibogaine? Because an ibogaine trip is notoriously grueling, sometimes lasting a full 24 hours or more.
After a single dose of ibogaine, the critical period in the mice stayed open for something on the order of 2 to 4 weeks.
Wait, really? Weeks?
Yes. Weeks of plasticity.
So here's where it gets really interesting, because this completely flips the cultural narrative on its head.
It really does.
For decades, society and the media have obsessed over the trip. The peak of the experience, the visual hallucinations, the mystical ego dissolution. We treat those few hours as the main event.
We think the trip is the medicine.
Exactly. But this science says the exact opposite. The trip is merely the duration of the opening. The real action, the actual structural healing, is happening in the valley in the quiet days and weeks afterward.
If this translates to humans, the altered state of consciousness is just the key turning in the lock. It is what happens next that matters.
Wow.
For years, clinicians in the psychedelic space have talked about the concept of integration, the deliberate therapeutic work of making sense of a session and building new habits in the aftermath.
Right.
But integration was often viewed as a soft science, a clinical intuition, or just an optional add-on to the main event.
Yeah, it was often framed as make sure you journal and talk about your feelings so you don't forget the cool stuff you saw.
But this research provides a concrete biological mechanism for why integration is the whole point. Integration is the literal act of writing into a temporarily malleable cortex.
Because your brain is a sponge again.
Yes, but only for a limited time. If you waste that window, if you take a psychedelic and immediately go back to your old stressful environment, your old toxic habits, your old avoidance patterns, the window will eventually close with nothing to show for it.
The cement dries again. And you've basically drawn the exact same destructive lines you had before.
But if you use that window with targeted therapy, with deliberate behavioral practice, with healthy new routines, that is when the profound, lasting change actually consolidates.
You're doing the work while the scaffolding is out of the way.
You are actively building new neural pathways, yes.
This also perfectly explains that famous afterglow effect people always talk about, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Where for a week or two after a profound session, they feel lighter, more adaptable, less easily triggered by things that used to upset them. We always just assumed that was just a lingering good mood.
The science suggests it is actually the felt subjective sense of a brain that is literally physically plastic again. In neuroscience, there is a term for these compounds, psychoplastogens.
Psychoplastogens. I love that word, but we definitely need to define it.
It means they rapidly promote the growth of new structural and functional neural plasticity. They literally help grow new dendritic spines and synapses.
Growing new hardware.
Essentially, yes. The article mentions that this is driven by specific mechanisms like BDNF and the MTOR pathway.
Okay, let's translate those acronyms so we don't leave anyone behind.
Good idea.
BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which acts almost like Miracle-Grow for your neurons. It fertilizes new connections.
Right.
And the MTOR pathway basically signals cells to grow and synthesize proteins. They are literally the brain's construction crew, and the psychedelics are calling them to the job site.
What the critical period research does is tie all these scattered observations together.
The puzzle pieces are fitting.
Exactly. The growth of new spines, the afterglow, the dissolving of the paraneuronal nets, it is all facets of the exact same phenomenon. For a brief window of time, a patch of your adult cortex is reverting to a younger, highly malleable state.
It is genuinely thrilling. But, you know, if the brain is left this malleable, this physically open and unshielded for weeks at a time.
Yes.
What happens if the wrong things get written into it? I feel like this shifts us from the excitement of the discovery to some very necessary, honest cautions.
We have to remember that the load-bearing evidence for everything we're discussing today is entirely based in mice.
Right.
A reopened social reward window in a rodent is a massive biological discovery, but it is not a direct one-to-one map for fixing complex human trauma.
We aren't mice.
No, we aren't. We still do not know for sure if human critical periods reopen in the exact same way or how broadly this effect generalizes across the human brain.
And the article is very clear about something that I think gets lost in the modern hype around psychedelics.
What's that?
An open window of plasticity is strictly neutral.
Ah,
It isn't inherently good or inherently bad. It is just open. It can let in profound life-altering healing, but it also makes the brain deeply, dangerously vulnerable to bad input.
This raises an important question about how we approach these substances practically. If your brain's protective scaffolding is temporarily gone, you are highly susceptible to your environment.
Highly susceptible.
This biological reality proves that the concepts of set and setting, your mindset and your physical environment, along with highly skilled support, are not just spa-like luxuries to make a trip feel nicer.
Right, they aren't just mood lighting.
No, they are biological necessities to protect an unshielded brain.
So what does this all mean? I want to ask you, the listener, a very pointed question. If your brain scaffolding is suddenly dissolved, who exactly is standing around you while the cement is wet?
That's the critical question.
What kind of environment are you walking back into during those 2 weeks of extreme plasticity? Are you going back to a high-stress job, a toxic relationship, an environment that reinforces your deepest fears?
Because your brain will learn from whatever is there.
Exactly. Your brain is going to absorb that chaotic reality just as efficiently as it would absorb professional therapy.
These are not magic pills that unilaterally fix depression or trauma just by swallowing them. They are catalysts that create a state of profound vulnerability.
A blank slate.
Reopening a critical period is a return to a formative state of childhood. We protect children because their brains are forming and absorbing everything around them.
Right.
If you are going to intentionally return your adult brain to that formative state, you have to protect yourself with the exact same level of care.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. You are stepping back into the vulnerability of childhood. You need the proper container so that the new lines you draw are the ones you actually want.
The very property that makes these compounds so uniquely promising for healing is the exact same property that makes them so powerful in ways we do not yet fully understand. Respect for the mechanism is mandatory.
Let's bring this all together because we've covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
We started with Hubel and Weisel's kittens, proving that early developmental windows close and permanently prune our neural connections.
And we learned about the lock.
Right. That the lock keeping our adult brains rigid is physical. These molecular casts called perineuronal nets. And we explored the astonishing 2023 discovery that classic psychedelics act as a master key, dissolving those nets and reopening those childhood critical periods.
And crucially, we learned that the window stays open in proportion to the duration of the acute trip.
The biological clock.
Yes. It completely reframes the definition of what the medicine actually is. The altered state is just the key unlocking the door. The integration, the deliberate behavioral work done in the days and nights that follow is where the actual healing lives.
The wisest use of these states isn't about chasing the incredible view from the peak. It's about the deliberate hard work you do down in the valley while the door is still open and the cement is still wet.
It is entirely about what gets built in the valley.
We want to leave you with a final thought to chew on today, because this science isn't just abstract biology.
No, it's very personal.
It touches on the core of who we are, how we get stuck, and how we change. If modern science can temporarily hand you the master key to revert a patch of your adult mind back to the unwritten, effortless plasticity of childhood, what ingrained fear, broken trust, or rigid belief would you choose to rewrite first?